This week's show is sponsored by Whimsies by Wellness.
Have you ever wondered how a chihuahua descended from a wolf?
All over the world, humans have been domesticating dogs for tens of thousands of years. And over that time, dogs have shown an extraordinary ability to adapt.
And humans have shown an extraordinary obsession with selective breeding.
But how much of our dog's ability to adapt is genetic? And how much is the impact of the environment they live in?
And how can modern dogs adapt to the big things?
Welcome to the Dog Scholar.
We should say a big thank you to Harper, who was the inspiration for this week's episode. How do dogs adapt to major physical changes? Well, a Dutch study looked at this and they interviewed 44 dog owners following their dog's amputation of a limb. And they were asked questions about how well their dogs adapted, how long it took them to adapt, and what changes in behaviour they saw. Now, most of the dogs adapted super quickly, within a month of surgery, actually. 41 out of 44 adapted really, really well. 33 of the dogs adapted a lot more quickly than their owners expected, and only 14 of the 44 dogs showed any kind of changes in their behaviour. Dogs really quickly adapted to major physical changes super successfully. And the behavioural changes they saw might have actually been due to fear or anxiety, because the dog felt like it couldn't defend itself quite as well. So really interesting study.
It really is. I think it's amazing. Jamie's got real first-hand experience in this, haven't you?
Yeah, so Tinkerbell here is now one of my young dogs. As you can see, she's minus a shoulder and minus a leg. So following an inexplicable injury of sorts to her shoulder when she was around about 7-8 months old, the decision was taken by the vet that it would be in her best interest to amputate both the shoulder and the leg. And I have to be completely honest, it wasn't something that prior to speaking to the vet that I agreed with. I'm very much she's already got vision in only one eye. You know, she's blind in one eye from a very, very young age. And then I'm seeing, well, the shoulders go in and the legs go in. And, you know, my sort of approach to things like that with animals is, you know, is the animal going to thrive? Is it in the animal's best interest? Obviously, if euthanasia were to be considered, then would that be in the best interest of the animal's long-term welfare? I was happy with that decision being taken. Much as it would break my heart, I was happy as in terms of I believe that I would be doing the best thing by her if I were to go ahead and instruct euthanasia. But the vet decided otherwise and gave me a firm promise, if you like, that the welfare wouldn't be impaired. So away she went and had the shoulder and the leg amputated. And within 24 hours of coming home, even while she still had the drain in, the surgical drain in her shoulder, this remaining leg shifted slightly across to the centre to act more like a trike. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Away she went. 200 mile an hour as she had done at any other time. You know, there was we were absolutely flabbergasted. Wow. By the fact there was no tail going like mad, you know, exactly the same exuberance, exactly the same dog coming out and, you know, following surgery as went in. And we've got a double flight of stairs in our house. She's just up and down it. I was trying to stop her. We were trying to stop her, but she just ran off up and ran back down again. Occasionally took a couple of slips and slides and tumbles when she went out onto grass. But I mean, you see her now, blimey, she leaps up and you can't stop her.
Wow.
She leaps up and down on top of it to the point that on my social media platforms, we have a hashtag Be More Tink.
Yeah.
You know, that because it is, that's the way that you need to live your life. That's resilience. That's taking adversity and dealing with it. And it's something that, you know, no doubt we'll touch on as we go on later on, but it's something that I believe that animals possess that capacity. And it's a capacity that we as humans, as overthinkers, as overcomplicators have lost. And I think that that is what we love in dogs, is the thing that we lack.
Mm.
And that ability to take each day and each challenge and deal with it absolutely head on with a wagging tail.
Do you think that's why dogs can adapt so well and so quickly to things that humans would find really difficult to?
Dogs don't, as far as we know, dogs don't possess the capacity to think on their future and how problematic that's going to be now that I'm in this situation. The fact is, I'm in this situation, I do this, I manage this situation, I deal, on I go. That resilience, you know, there's no sort of like, they're not hindered by what have I lost? You know, what am I not going to experience now as a result of my situation? I'm living right now, right for the moment. And I think that's exactly how everybody else should live.
I think they're also blessed with not having any sense of what will others think of me?
Mm.
I think that's another blessing that they have. And I think, you know, dogs show, and to be honest, all animals except us, really, they show incredible physical resilience. They literally just get on with it, don't they? And I think we're kind of hindered by our ability to have in-depth thought and feelings on things.
Yeah. If that was us, you know, we would require months of probably physical rehabilitation, psychological rehabilitation.
Years of worrying about what will people be attracted to me anymore? Yeah. Will I be able to work? All this kind of stuff.
Am I the same as I was before? Yeah. You know, well, like you say, work, all manner of things.
Yeah.
Run up and down the garden steps, just crack on. That's the dog.
It does make me wonder how effectively and whether dogs can project into the future in the same way that we can, that kind of mental time travel piece. There is some evidence that they can. I read some quite interesting studies, but I don't know whether they think about the implications of things to the extent that we do. And conversely, I wonder whether our human expectations might hold dogs back a bit.
I think in a lot of cases, I think generally speaking, that need to just survive and move on is very apparent in other animals, where that survival instinct in us isn't as genetically instilled on us as maybe it once was through maybe society's influence, and how it's not been needed. Do you know what I mean? You can see it in like reality TV programs where they drop people on an island and some people just thrive. Some of them go to bits and go, I've had enough. I can't do it. I just can't do it. Yeah. And that you never truly know if you've got that ability to just crack on and survive until you're put in that situation. And that's something that dogs are blessed with, because they don't have to think about it. It just happens.
I think with that lack of thought as well, you find a lack of risk. Yeah. In dogs, they don't perceive risk in the same way that humans would be. And if anybody were to say, oh, my dog does, you know, if that were the case, I wouldn't chase a deer across a busy road. I wouldn't, you know, put myself in situations.
There's no dynamic risk assessment.
No, there isn't. There is a deer, I'm going. Yeah. You know, and that's it. Deer, run, chase. Yeah. And those sort of things, you know, squirrel, run. I'm not thinking about the fact that I'm at risk.
I have a great way of explain that with clients, like trying to have them understand. They don't have any quest for explanation or reason. So if you were to have like a drain, fill it with tennis balls and then tilt it, one ball would hit the floor, but your dog would not look at that ball and go, where's that come from? They would chase that ball while all them balls carried on falling. And it's that kind of attitude towards life where I see, I act, I do, I move on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it sounds like you had quite a quandary between quality of life and quantity of life, but you found that you were wrong in that, because you were originally going to put Tink down.
So I mean, the hats off to the vet, because I'm a difficult person to convince, but I'll bow to greater experience and I'll grow to an expertise, and you know, and that's what the vet has. You know, I was 100% like committed to, okay, this is tragic, it's terrible, but it's the best thing for her long term. You know, is she going to thrive? No, I don't think she is. So this is what we need to do. But the beautiful thing about this particular vet was that perhaps about 5 months earlier, I'd taken another one of my dogs there who had just basically spontaneously developed a terrible heart condition. And I went there and said to the vet, you know, blah, 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 what's going on along with my wife? And the vet said, we could send them away and have them tested. I said, if it was your dog and you were in this situation with your dog now, what would you do? And she said, I'd put to sleep. I said, then put to sleep.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that for me completely and utterly won my faith.
Yeah.
Because I thought, if you're going to speak to me like that, bang, you know? And so I trusted the second time and they were bang on.
And that study was great in showing us that dogs really can adapt to major changes. The next study that I found was looking at what dogs might use to adapt to changes. And it looked at something called incidental memory. Now, that's when you remember something without trying to. And it's a bit like, I don't know, remembering the colour of someone's shirt in a cafe or the song that was playing without even thinking about it. And dogs could use information they remember without trying to in order to adapt to new situations. And that's what this study looked at. Now, dogs were tied up next to four containers with food in them, and they were allowed to eat from only two of them. And then they were taken away. And then after a short time, the dogs were brought back to the same area, but there were new identical containers. And they recorded which containers the dogs went to. And that setup was a bit like a real life situation where dogs would have to adapt and make choices based on the things that they remembered from before without trying to. Now, out of 12 dogs, 11 of them chose containers that they hadn't eaten in before. So that showed that they were using incidental memory. Now, Dogs can adapt to their surroundings by remembering past experiences that they have, and they use that to drive their choices. In this case, it was where to find food, and that would apply in the wild, arguably, as well. See, dogs don't just depend on trained behaviours or those basic associations, they're also relying on incidental memory. And that's really important for adapting, because it lets dogs handle new and unexpected situations using things they've experienced before.
The Nederland from breeding affects that, because when we're talking about you know, being inquisitive enough to try new things and being led by incidental memory as well, the genetic ability to have the courage to test new things also plays a part in that. You know, we as humans hinder their ability to just press on sometimes by kind of, you know, pushing our expectations and our fears of the unknown onto our dogs. And now you end up with a bit more of a nervous dog that won't try new things. I've seen many examples of dogs that you just go, they will absolutely fold in a new environment. And I've seen dogs who are just like, bring it on. Doesn't it's a dog eat dog world. Doggy.
This is funny. So me and Danny were talking about this episode and I said, it's a dog eat dog world.
And can I interrupt? I went, what? Say that again. When it's a dog eat dog world, I went, f***ing hell. She went, what? I went, I've literally, how long have I been around dogs? I always thought it was a doggy dog world, not dog eat dog world. How the hell? Yeah, how the hell has that got past me? And we were laughing with me. Charlotte walked in when we were on the corner. I went, Charlotte, what's that phrase? It's a doggy, a dog what? Doggy. I went, oh my God.
Tell me, what's the most pointless incidental memory you've got?
God. Give me some, what's yours?
I remember the steps up to my very first classroom that was like an outdoor hut, you know, like a like construction work, not metal, but one of the old, we used to call it an Elliot hut. When I'm tired, I can almost like put myself into a bit of a state of like self-hypnosis to a degree where I can take myself back to that classroom. I can walk in, I can smell the smells, I can see the alphabet going around the wall, I can see where the teacher's desk is, I can see everything. I can see everything as though I was there. I find it quite bizarre.
I can do that.
Yeah. I find it weird to think, why would my brain choose to remember that? There was nothing significant happened there that I'm aware of, yet I can't remember my PIN number.
And it just goes to show how much your brain processes incidentally without even thinking about it, and how amazing it must be for dogs. Actually,
I have an annoyance with it. I only have to listen to like a song once or twice and I know the words to it. And I always say to myself, I used to say to my mum, do you know, if I could just swap that for a different ability that would aid me better in life, that would be great, that, wouldn't it? And even from a kid, like my mum and dad, like, used to always listen to Motown. God, there isn't a Motown song I couldn't sing from start to finish. And that's just from being on holiday and hearing it by the side of the pool. And that.
I wonder what dogs remember, though. I mean, that was quite helpful because it could show us clearly what it was remembering. Yeah. But I wonder what it is that they remember incidentally and use. You know, like, we'll go, oh, that's really useful. I remember that from before. I'll do that here.
Mm. I don't know. I mean, you could take dogs into... It's very, very difficult because we have this habit. Me, you know, I put my hands up and I admit that I have this habit of when it's me, I just remember something.
Yeah.
When it's a dog, there's got to be some kind of associative learning event that's taken place and it can't just suddenly be a remembering of the game, because why would they... But...
Maybe it does.
Yeah, maybe and if it does, great. And
I have a number of locations that when I take my dogs, I'm in the van. There's no windows to it. They're in crates in the van.
Yeah.
And... when we get there, I can hear them getting all excited before I've even stopped. And it's always at the same place.
Yeah.
And it's like this, I had this picture of like Liam Neeson going like, 20 seconds, turn left, 40 seconds, turn right, stop at the lights, there's a church bell on there. You know what I mean? But it's like a sixth sense, it's mad. And I hear clients say this, every time I pull in, I can hear them getting excited. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So there we go, dogs can definitely incidentally remember stuff. I like it. This week's show is sponsored by Whimsies by Wellness. A good dental chew should be a win-win. Your dog gets a treat they can take off to a corner and chew on, and you get a significant improvement in their breath and all-round oral health. The unique shape of the hedgehog, alligator, and toothbrush chews helps clean between teeth and prevent the buildup of plaque and tartar. Look out for Whimsies at pet stores or order online by clicking the link in the description. The next study examined the role of new retrogenes in dogs adapting to their environment over time through evolution. Now, a retrogene is a very unique kind of gene that's created when information from an existing gene is copied and put back into the DNA. So how do genes change a species to adapt to different environments? Researchers used various methods to unpick dogs' DNA. They identified any retrogenes and used various kinds of analyses to predict the role of those retrogenes in the changes that resulted in differences seen in dog breeds. And they found more than 3,000 copies of retrogenes, or backup copies, if you like, which came from more than 1,200 original genes. Most of them were really carefully selected to stay in the dog's DNA to make functional changes. So it certainly wasn't an accident that they stayed there. And they found retrogenes that improved dogs' ability to get rid of waste and toxins so they could adapt to feeding off waste sites without getting ill. Retrogenes were very often found moving on and off the X chromosome. So the changes that they trigger were passed on through breeding, through natural selection. So this study concluded that retrogenes play a really crucial role in the adaptive evolution of dogs. And those retrogenes would not only contribute to the genetic diversity, but they'd also provide really functional evolutionary advantages that help dogs to adapt to specific environments.
We've seen an example of this when we started the study and we went to Cardiff University. What was the guy's name? I think he's doing his PhD, and he goes over to the dogs that are living in...
Eric.
The dogs live in radioactive areas. Yeah. Where was it?
Chernobyl.
That was where it was.
Yeah.
And he said they've adapted. They're eating things that are radioactive but thriving.
Yeah.
There we go.
Imagine that, eating radioactive waste and still survive. Mind you, if people can survive my cooking, they can probably survive anything.
Do you know the relative it is? We're eating fast food and it's killing us all slowly, and they're eating radioactive waste and thriving. Yeah.
What is that maybe about? There's something in it.
Yeah, what is that about? Yeah. Madness. Maybe there's a scope for involving that sort of science in breeding schemes.
Yeah, to breed more adaptive dogs, you mean? Yeah.
I think really there's certainly a place in breeding schemes to breed fitter
dogs. Pull the socks up.
Do your job properly, or don't do it at all.
This is the problem, these adaptive qualities. You know, when you think of how physically resilient a dog is, how many dogs that aren't emotionally resilient is unbelievable. You know, you can get a lot of the dogs I'm dealing with, it's all about stress inoculation. We're teaching them to cope in different environments because they literally can't cope with the unknown.
Yeah.
So again, that's something to be looked at as well. You know, the temperament of dogs matters.
Yeah. Mm. What are your dogs genetically adapted for?
Most of them have needed work with understanding the world around them. What we have to understand, people at home, is what we see every day, we take for granted. You know, your dog doesn't know what tractors and cars and planes and fireworks are. So sometimes if they're not quite as emotionally resilient, we have to bridge them gaps of understanding and teach them what the outcomes are. It's fine, got nothing to worry about. Make them familiar with it. Ironically, you know, before Logan come into his own, I had to do a load of work with that, which is, you know, you'd say is unusual considering I've labelled him as borderline a dominant dog. But as soon as he hit 6 months old, he was a different dog.
Wow.
Absolutely different dog. Taught me a lesson, him. You know, as a working dog, if someone was going to trial that dog, they'd go, no, he needs a home, he won't make it. 6 months came and that dog changed. He literally changed, yeah.
See, my dog's hairlessness is a genetic mutation. The Sholo's hairlessness is based on a particular gene that mutated, which meant the dogs had no hair. You can also have coated Sholos.
Right.
So you have dogs like mine that have got a full normal coat of hair. And the same genetic mutation that means they don't have any hair also means they have incomplete dentation.
Yeah.
So my dogs haven't got a full set of teeth. Jimmy's got most of them except for one canine. Luther's got most of them, just doesn't have canines. Red's got hardly any.
Yeah.
But the dogs, the Sholos that have fur, have a full set of gnashes.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
It's mad the way genes work like that. I remember reading something about asthma a while ago when my daughter was struggling, and how it's the same gene as eczema.
Yeah.
And it's mad the way like it things like that can cross over and it shares. It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you were talking about when we have so much power over creating these genes and these abilities to adapt and everything, it's astonishing how wrong we've got it when it comes to breeding dogs. Like how many unhealthy dogs are bred. And it's overlooked and everyone's just cracking on like it's the norm. It's quite disturbing to me. Like, it really bothers me. Health should be a number one priority, followed by workability.
Totally agree. But what we can see from these studies is that big or small, dogs are really good at adapting to changes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I'd say better at physical changes than emotional changes a lot of cases.
That absolutely blew my mind, that amputation study.
Yeah.
Talking of things that blow my mind, Jamie, tell me about the listener questions.
I have the first question, which is from Sue, who lives in North Piddle in Worcester. Big question that I'm asking to deliberately spark a debate. Come on, Sue. Bring it on. The bigger the better.
Like I'm a master debater.
The bigger the better, my friend. But I also really want to hear your opinions. Do you think we should stop breeding pedigree dogs?
I think we should seriously stop charging the money we're charging for them. I think that's contributing to a massive problem that's happening in society as we know it.
My thoughts on the breeding of pedigree dogs, to be completely honest with you, I don't even like, I've bred Labradors, okay? I haven't bred them because they're Labradors. I bred them because they are sound dogs, sound temperament, sound ability to be able to go on healthy, go on and live and work with people, you know, thrive in the environment that they're going into. The idea of breeding a dog or protecting breeds of dogs just because it's that breed of dog and like that breed, I consider to be absolutely selfish.
Either.
If there is no welfare advantage to the dog, I mean, if you take it right the way back, you know, every dog's got a hodgepodge of everything in there at some point, haven't they? Anyway, but if you say, I just want to breed a dog because I like this breed of dog, but there's no welfare advantage for that dog, and then you say, well, I'm going to try and breed this dog so it's even healthier as this dog, but I want this dog. If that's your underpinning rationale, you know, your justification for breeding the dog, then I disagree with it. And I think fitness and function need to absolutely be at the forefront of any and every breeding program.
Fun fact for you, the Sholos, the breed of dog that I keep, have never been selectively bred, and they're one of the most primitive dogs that you can get. They regularly live up to 15 to 20 years.
And that's probably why a lot of them have bad nerve, and that's probably like wolves are nervy. They're not, everyone thinks like, oh, big bad wolf, but they'll flee and avoid conflict.
Because they spot danger. Because they need
to survive. You can't be surviving if you're challenging everything you see. Yeah. So that comes hand in hand. I think when we stop becoming reliant on dogs for work and to use for you know, to help us exist, I think as soon as it became a shift towards, now we're just going to breed to an aesthetic human specification, I want this to look like this, we absolutely sacrificed health for aesthetics. And to me, I think that's awful. And it can all be bred back out by just selecting what you're breeding from. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I would like to see, you know, I'd be all behind dog shows that looked at the fittest, most, without it being grossly sort of like, you know, ultra muscle pumped sort of steroid sort of example
healthy
of
dogs, healthy
fit
version.
Healthy dogs, doesn't matter what the breed is, fit for purpose as well, so like where you do working trials and stuff like dogs that do what they should do, you know, sheepdog trials and stuff like that, doing their job and doing it well.
People just
think that
another one is oh, I think she'll be a great mum, breed them. No, it's not like a necessity. There's a greater issue that, you know, we're overrun with dogs. There's so many dogs that are in need because we're just pumping them out for profit, and then everyone just turns the back when it all goes wrong, and everyone else, all the good, like all us trying to do good, have to pick up the pieces. Do you know what I mean?
More dogs than homes.
I know. Yeah.
What about the next question, Jay?
The next question would be question two. Ooh. And that one comes from James. I've worked with dogs in Cambodia. This is James, not me. James has worked with dogs in Cambodia for the last 2 years. I returned to the UK for a few months and the dogs felt very different to work and train with. Cambodian dogs feel more independent, higher anxiety, this is what you were just saying, Danny, wasn't it, with the wolves and the Sholos, higher anxiety, lower bite threshold, lower food drive, prone to severe resource guarding. How much of this would be due to genetics and how much would be due to the environment? Or is the environment encouraging these traits to be passed on? That's a nice question.
And I think the last point that he made pretty much
it is.
Sums
I was going to say it's up our street,
that,
isn't it? Yeah. Not because we're intelligent.
I think it is the interplay between the genetics and the environment is absolutely encouraging those traits to be passed on, because those dogs that have those traits are more successful and they're more likely to breed.
I agree with you. It's a cooperation of those symbiosis. Of those different things coming together.
That's all we've got time for this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend, because if they don't like it, maybe their dogs will.
Over to you, Danny. What's your final thoughts?
Jamie, to be honest, I think I'm going to pinch one of your quotes that I've heard you say before. When we're talking about adaptation in dogs, you know, as a dog trainer, we see a lot of dogs struggling to accept the environment. And as I've said in this episode, bridging that gap of a lack of understanding to understanding is very important as pet owners and trainers. You're all trainers if you're training your dog. Jamie once said, a really good trainer handler makes molehills out of mountains. And I think that's a real powerful statement to make. That's what you want to do. You might feel like really emotionally attached that your dog's struggling because a car's going past. But remember, it's just a car going past. Take the time to break it down and make it relevant to your dog. Make that mountain a molehill.
Absolutely, because dogs can adapt to both.
Yeah.
See you next week.